Hello, everybody. I think the main course is over now, and I'd like to welcome Ray Murray to the stand, to the platform to give us a talk on hopefully colourful and not too often heard stories from the stewards room.
The right one here, Luke.
The hand ones.
Everyone can hear. Yeah. I was at a function not long after I arrived in Sydney, and I asked that same question. Can everyone hear? And Shane Dye was sitting at a table over to the right. He said, "I can hear, but I'm perfectly happy to change places with someone who can't." Thank you for the invite to come along, and I wouldn't want to knock back the opportunity of coming across to Adelaide anyway, but when Luke said that it was for the owners, that was my entry into racing. My dad raced a lot of horses. He was the foundation member of the owners and trainers in Southwest Districts of Victoria. He'd have turned in his grave if I said no, Luke, so thank you for asking us along. My career has spanned 46 years. I've recently handed over the reins at Racing New South Wales, but I sort of can skite about running running inquiries in every state of Australia, and I pick up South Australia by virtue of the fact that I did conduct a drug inquiry here from Broken Hills. So I have transversed Australia, and it's been wonderful industry to be part of. A Chinese philosopher that we're all well attuned to, Confucius, said, "Choose a work you love and you'll never work another day in your life." I don't know if he quite had his head around being a chief steward, but it nearly qualifies. I started back in 1970 in Victoria in the Southwest Districts, and I don't know, transversely it was the year I got married and my punting bank became the housekeeping money. But I'll tell you the story of the first day I worked. I can remember that well as a steward. Ross Gawley trained horses for Dad. He was a very successful trainer. He went from Warrnambool eventually to Cranbourne, but trained a lot of group, list of winners. But I was only 22, I think, and I used to put Ross's money on for him. And anyway, our chief steward, Doug McDonald, he was pretty fastidious. In those days, you had to fill out the nomination form, you had to sign the damn thing. And one of his first jobs, he'd flick through, and Ross hadn't signed his. He'd probably rang it through. And he said, "Well, Ray," he said, "in this job, you've got to be a bastard to do it." He said, "And the sooner they learn that, the better." He said, "Go down and find Ross Gawley, $25. So that was my first job. I love, "How are you, Ross?" "Great, Ray, how are you?" I said, "I've got a new job, Ross, taking on being a cadet steward." "Oh, that's good, you'll love that." And I said, "And Ross, you'll find $25. Well, the conversation went downhill from there. One of the earlier memories was the Royal School Regal Vista ring-in at Casterton. Remember that well. And I got a bit involved in harness racing at the same time when the local stewards at Terang, old Dan O'Grady, was the president of the trots and the gallops, and he got me involved because they wouldn't work with the Melbourne stewards. In 1974, I went down to Melbourne and I worked for 12 months in harness racing. John Schreck was there at the time, and his name would be pretty familiar, I think, with most people. And when Emily was talking earlier about some trepidation about travelling in a 10-seater plane to a race meeting, we used to travel to meetings in Victoria in the most rust-bucket four-seater planes you've ever seen. And John wasn't too keen on planes anyway, and I can recall we took off from Essendon Airport. We were flying to Nia or somewhere we were going that night, just the two of us, pilot, John sitting behind the pilot, and we take off, and it's just fog and misty rain as Melbourne could be, and the radio's crackling, no flight path available, keep circling Essendon. He said, this is bloody lovely. And anyway, all of a sudden, the seat, pilot's seat slipped back into John's lap and slipped off the runners it was on. So the pilot's got a big, out of the seat, and he's back between the two of us, and he's got a big screwdriver, and he's trying to reinstate the seat. I'll never forget, John said, look, I might be the pilot of this bloody plane, but he said, I'm the chairman of stewards tonight, and I'm ordering you back into that seat until you land it. The planes were owned by a committeeman, and I guess that's why we were travelling. It was probably some contra deal there, and one of the first appeals I sat on, there was a horse that had not been given every chance to win, or was pulled up in the vernacular. There was the trainer, the owner, and the driver, all represented by lawyers, and this chap Nicholas, who owns the planes, he was sitting there on the panel of the Victorian Trotting Control Board, as they were called in those days. And anyway, the lawyer is questioning the stewards, and he dozed off to sleep, the committeeman. And anyway, he sort of came to attention, and he stood up and he said, looking at his watch, I've been asleep an hour. And he said, you're still asking the same question as you were asking when I went to sleep. Well, he was part right. It was the same question, but we'd moved along about two sets of lawyers. So it didn't say much for what attention the particular legal people were getting from the thrust of their arguments. But I moved on from there to Tassie, and it was an interesting time. Tasmanian harness racing, and I think it was more a case of I didn't take a step back than I took a step forward to go there. But there was a police inquiry, some violence in the industry down there. A trainer had been pretty nastily bashed. But we had some interesting times, and I remember a race meeting at St. Mary's. Actually, there'd been some issue with one of the stewards' families, and there was two meetings on in the same day. St. Mary's, they raced around the golf course. There was no inside rail. And the chief steward wouldn't normally have gone there. He'd have gone to the main meeting on the day. So I lobbed up there, and I brought in a couple of swab tins, and certainly never had swabbed anyone at St. Mary's. We cleaned out a chook shed, I remember, to do it. And anyway, during the course of the day, there was a horse in a race, and in the straight, to the use of vernacular, he broke the horse's jaw pulling it up. So we got in and gave him 12 months. He actually struck me at the Hobart show before I left. When I was leaving there, and he said, you know why I pulled it up? He said, I seen you walking in with two swab tins. He said, I knew I was going to get 12 months. I thought I'd take the risk that he won't see it. So he got 12 months. And in the last race, his mate, who'd also touched his horse up with caffeine, they both pulled up on the side of the road, came from the same area. When I told him I was swabbing him, he took off up the main street of St. Mary's, and I had to get him a car. So I said, I got more petrol than you have, you know, so eventually he turned round, back he went, but he finished up doing 12 months too. So I had fond memories of the St. Mary's track. I went from Tassie to Western Australia, and still in harness racing at that point, 78 to 82. And it was a great time, though, a lot of good horses, very professional industry, Pure Steel, San Simeon might be names that you know. Ran the 82 into Dominion there, Rhett's Law. Some interesting characters again. Went to a place called Narrogin, and wasn't just a Saturday non-tab it actually was, and the young vet came in. He'd said, "I've never swabbed at a meeting before." And I took him through the drill of how he did the documentation, how he sealed the samples. Lo and behold, we got a positive swab. We dealt with the trainer, gave him, disqualified him, gave him time. And I went back to Narrogin about 6 months later, and the same vet's there, and I said, "You might be interested, did you know you got a positive swab with your first swab?" And he said, "I'm not one bit surprised." And I said, "Why is that?" He said, "Well, he offered me $400 to tip the swab out on the ground." I said, "Well, that would have been a handy bit of information if you'd let me know." And he said, "Well, I thought they all did that." There were tough old times. There was a trainer down there used to get into a bit of trouble, and you'd have to go around and visit and deliver.
Sorry, I am enjoying it, and I could stand a swab.
Good on you, mate. Yeah. We used to have to visit from time to time with a bit of paperwork, usually not good news for him. And what he used to do, he had this big Alsatian dog on a lead, and he used to be on a running chain. But if you backed up against the wall of the stable and edged along, you used to be able to get past him. And he'd always encourage you, you'll be right, there's room there. But I'll swear, every time I went around, and every time the news got worse for the trainer, that bloody chain got longer. '82, I came back to Victoria, worked under Pat Lawler. The VRC, again, seen some great racing there. Seen worked the day Kiwi won the Melbourne Cup. Seen the Bone Crusher, our Waverley Star, great, probably one of the greatest Cox plates ever. Kingston Town and Manicato won the $1 million. God, we talk about $1 million now. They win it as two-year-olds, don't they? But they were exceptional horses. Tell a story about Edenhope. Pat used to get a bit on toe, and he Edenhope here, of course, is almost halfway between our states. But Pat said, "Why don't you go to Edenhope?" He hadn't sent a VRC steward there. He said, "Not happy with the way things are going on there." He said, "I want you to go over and ruffle the place up and get it going right." So I lobbed at this Edenhope meeting, and we got going. The first race, the starter was a lovely fella, local farmer. And anyway, put the horses in for the first race, and a couple of horses broke through, and then he hit the button and let the rest of them go. And I thought, God almighty, I'll be in trouble when I get back here. So I got him in and I said, "Look, that's not good enough. You've got to be more careful and more professional." So second race, you wouldn't want to know, he's hit the button with one still out the back. He never loaded it. So I got him in and I said, "Look, enough's enough. You seem a lovely fella, but I'm going to have to stand you down. I can't ride up for the third race." And he said, "No worries, that's great." And he said, "Just come here though." And I walked around the table to where he was. He said, "See that blue John Deere tractor towing the stalls?" And I said, "Yeah, yeah." He said, "That's my tractor. And when I go home, that's when I'm driving." So he's probably still starting at Edenhope. Went from there, and funny to say, another ring in probably defined a little bit of my career, because the fine cotton matter happened in Queensland, and they wanted a bit of a fresh face, and I was asked to go to Queensland, and went up there in 1986. I think fine cotton was about 85. It's funny, when I got up there very early in the piece, the first couple of days, I got the stewards around the table and said, "Well, the reports on Queensland racing aren't really great." I said, "I'm told that fine cotton's not the first ring-in that's happened here." And one of the stewards who'd recently joined the panel, ex-jockey, put his hand up. He said, "You're right, boss." He said, "I rode one." He said, I was riding for the leading trainer, and he said, I rode a three-year-old filly in the first race. And he said, then I was on another three-year-old, another maiden riding a three-year-old filly in the third. And he said, the trainer's given me some instructions. And he said, I looked over at the horse. I said, what are you giving me instructions for? I rode that in the first race. And he said, I know. He said, the staff buggered it up. They bought the wrong horse. But he said, I can't afford the penalty. I said, well, how'd you go? He said, it went bloody side better than it did in the first. Tell you a story about it's funny how things work out at a place called Gatton. I don't know if any of you are familiar with the Gatton Race Club. It's a pretty ordinary track, but wonderful committee, lovely people. And the stewards that have worked for me will tell you I'm not the most even-tempered person if someone makes a blue. And anyway, Alan Reardon, who's chief steward and great steward, chief steward in Brisbane now, but at that stage he was just a member of the panel, and he was running the Gatton meeting, and an odds-on favourite burst through the barrier and galloped the lap. And Alan's in the chairman of steward stand, and he's trying to get onto the vet at the start with a walkie-talkie, and the vet was, well, to put it best, at its highest point, the vet was a cat and dog vet. He wasn't really a horse vet. Anyway, the next thing Alan sees, the damn horse is going into the barrier. They've hit the button, and off the field went. Well, the horse only went a couple of 100 metres, and he staggered to a stop. And Alan's so fearful of appearing in the office the next day, what he's going to say to me, how he's going to explain it. So they might have been having a beer or two during the steward's report, but they decided to introduce a bit of levity. So they got the steward's report, and instead of putting Dr. Smith the vet, Alan put in the report, hoping it would amuse me, Dr. Cockhead the vet, inspected the horse and passed it fit to start. So the practice was he'd throw it on my desk, the stewards, and I'd have a quick look at the stewards' report and fax it. Used to go to about 60 outlets around Australia. Anyway, that morning I got in first, and I didn't have much of a look at it, to be honest. I threw it on the fax pole, and around it went, and in it, Alan comes sheepishly, and he said, did you read the report? I said, don't have to read it. I said, everyone knows what happened. It was a nice old blue, wasn't it? And he said, where is the report? And I said, it's out there on the fax machine. I've never seen someone move so quickly between my office and the fax machine. And Alan spent the next 3 or 4 hours ringing every news agency in Australia trying to get this Dr. Cockhead out of the steward's report. I think he was successful all bar one. Can't leave Queensland without mentioning you talk about characters, Luke. He was a character. Vic Rail, trainer of O'Rourke. The morning I arrived in Queensland, Tom Murphy was one of the stewards. And he said, Ray, before you take your table, he said, I've got an inquiry to conduct, but just sit there. He said, this won't take long. And in came, I'd never heard of Vic Rail at that stage, nor had most people, I guess, unless you had to deal with him every day. Sit down, Mr. Rail. And Tom produced a minute glass, you know, those glasses with the sand, and he turned it over. He said, 1 minute, Mr. Rail, you've got an ineligible entry, and the practice was to fine him. And, well, Vic started out on a tirade. He started with the president of the club. He'd have got to the Pope eventually, and Tom turned over, $100, your minute's up. So that was my introduction to Queensland and to Vic Rail. But Vic, look, God bless his soul, he contracted EI, and that was sad, and it killed him. None of us knew what it was at the stage. And all the trainers distrusted him because Vic must have thought hygiene was a tall girl. He certainly didn't practice hygiene around his stables. And I always remember one of my stewards said to me, everyone thought Vic was doing something with the horses, and it wasn't a virus at all, or the Hendra virus that they contracted, and the horses had to die. But horses died. But and Wayne Flynn said to me, he said, the rats are so big, and Vic Stable, he said, the cats hold hands when they walk into the stable. Vic would say, you're picking on me. The stewards are picking on me. I said, I'll tell you something, Vic. Honestly, they'd run 100 yards not to have to talk to you. That was the sort of bloke he was. He turned up one day in thongs to ride work, and when I stopped him doing that, he's in rubber boots. Where in the rule book is rubber boots? You can't wear them. Well, of course, it didn't specifically say that, but Laurie Mayfield Smith said to me one day when they wrote the rule book, they never thought there was going to be a Vic Rail, and he really was a character. It was a sad time that his whole stable was lost and Vic was lost. And when I went to in 1995 to New South Wales, of course, I still rate EI as perhaps the saddest period of my career, to see racing closed down, so many horses suffering from that virus that just brought racing to a standstill. But lucky in Victoria, New South Wales, spent 21 years there, seen a lot of great racing, seen a lot of good horses. A couple of the characters I dealt with, I was talking there earlier to Joe Bowditch about one of them, Alan Robertson, who I don't know if his name's terribly familiar here across the border, but he was a very good jockey. More so a country jockey. But we were at Newcastle one day, and he was in an interference inquiry, and as those of you that know the sort of format of a steward's inquiry, it's usually the jockey's interfered with first will be asked, and then the fellow who's got a case to answer, and we show the video. And Robbo said, Michael B was the chief steward, can you take the video back a bit, about 100 yards, and just run it forward? And he said, no, back again, run it slow, stop it there. Michael said, well, what are we looking there? It's another 100 metres before the interference. He said, I'm paying a bloke with a bolt cap 200 metres to dig up the front yard of that house across the other side of the road, and I want to see if he's working. A lot of great memories, Bart Cummings. I'll never forget one day I walked around to Bart's stables. He had a horse with a TCO2 level getting up a bit higher than it should be. And I said to him, boss, you better look at your husbandry practices. That horse, the TCO2 level's getting up. He said, well, it didn't win. He said, how much more can I give it? He was pretty hard to beat with his one-liners. One of the funnier incidents I remember was we used to, well, still do, take the breathalyzer to the track, and had the Bob Nicholson, the racecourse detective, there one Saturday morning at Randwick. And with his breathalyzer, not that he needed to breathalyze this track rider, because when the trainer legged him up, he actually fell off the other side of the horse, which was a fair giveaway. Anyway, Bob lobbed at the races, and he said, sent this bloke home to sleep it off. He said, and I've told him to be here at midday, and I said, that'll be good, Bob. We'll bowl that over pretty quick. So anyway, Bob went to the door and put his head back in. He said, boss, I think we're in a bit of trouble. He said, this fella's been down to the Doncaster Hotel in the interim to get a bit of Dutch courage. Well, I said, look, he's here. Let's see what we can do with him. So Bob wheeled him in. It got pretty obvious. Conversation was out of the question. Anyway, and as he spun round in the steward's room at Randwick, there's a window there, and he stumbled, and he, to keep himself upright, he grabbed the Venetian blinds brought a whole set of Venetian blinds down. That didn't greatly impress the hierarchy at the Australian Turf Club, or Australian Jockey Club. Probably talking about protests as we were at the table here before, one that comes to mind and, I'd have to say to start off with, stewards don't rate too highly on the popularity ladder. If we fell off, we certainly wouldn't break a leg, but we weren't many steps up that day when we took the Villiers off Take Over Target. Take Over Target was a great horse, the horse that he beat home wasn't much good. I'm just drinking Honour at War, I think it was. And protest, I wouldn't say it was a tough protest, but it was tough in this way. He was just, Joe Janiak was just a hero, and so was this horse that was sold for $1,250. Actually, Tony Hartnell, who was chairman of the Racing New South Wales, owned the horse and sold it. And John Morris trained it initially. John said at a function, and I was sitting next to Tony, he said, Take Over Target, he said, had a lot of ability. I knew it had a lot of ability, but it was unsound. And Tony Hartnell said to me, well, he's got it 50% right. So I don't think he'd ever told Tony it had ability, but when we upheld that protest, I could tell the public weren't at all happy with the decision. So I opted for the coward's way out. I didn't go out to watch the parade of the horses for the next race. I busied myself doing the stewards report, and I thought, just when they're about to jump, I'll slip out. But by gee, that didn't work. And there was a couple of hundred people outside the stewards' draw who severely questioned my parentage and have continued to do for the next 10 years. That was never forgiven. But look, if there was anything that anyone wants to ask us a question, I'm happy to receive that. I feel privileged to be here, speak to the owners. Owners are the backbone. That was, as I said, my entry into racing. I respect greatly the role that the people in this industry who put their hands in their pockets and buy horses or breed horses and race them. If that doesn't happen, we don't have racing for some of the experts now on social media to commentate on, and it wouldn't be the industry that we love, or it wouldn't be the size that we have if there was not that popular support from owners who invariably subsidise the industry. But I'm happy to take any questions if someone had something that they'd like to ask. Yeah, okay. Well, 2008, we decided to change the whip rules. Australia, wherever you went in the world, people would say Australians are whip happy, and they were. Again, they were tinkered with at the start of the year. Wasn't at the behest of stewards, and we, you know, clearly the industry got it wrong. But it's salvageable. I think the whip rules could be changed so that there's actually less whip, but it's more flexible. And let's learn a lesson from what happened to the greyhound industry in New South Wales. If you think, and this is actually what happened in 2008, the first day of the new whip rules, a young girl came to me. She said, I'm with the Telegraph. I've never been to the races. My editor sent me out, wants me to interview the punters, see what they think of the whip rules, and then I've got to go down to the mall at Parramatta and ask the people down there what they think of the whip rules. I said, I can have you home at 1 o'clock. Go and ask one punter, and he'll tell you you can't hit them long enough and hard enough. Go and ask one person down the mall, and they'd say they should take the whips off jockeys. You shouldn't be able to hit a horse simply because it's in a gambling medium. And what we've got to remember, on course, and interested in racing are 5% of the population. The other 95% are in the Parramatta Mall. And if we don't drive the car that drive the vehicle that decides on matters of importance, such as instruments to assist jockeys to get the best out of their horses, if we allow a government inquiry, as happened with the greyhound industry, to make the decision for us, we mightn't find it too palatable, Richard. Yes.
Recently,